Today on Against the Grain, the banks and financiers are a common target on the left and off on the right, purportedly sucking the lifeblood out of the real industrial economy. Scholar Stephen Marr argues that while the financialization of the economy has intensified under neoliberalism, finance has played a central role in the growth of capitalism and the disciplining of labor from at least the Gilded Age. He discusses the recent rise of asset management companies Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock, which have concentrated ownership at a level unprecedented in the history of capitalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's a commonplace on the left that finance is a parasitic force on the economy, that the real economy is industrial, while finance is just a mechanism of siphoning off wealth from that productive yet beleaguered economy. My guest, Stephen Marr, is co-editor of the Socialist Register and assistant professor of economics at SUNY Cortland. With Scott Aquino, he's the author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance, from J.P. Morgan to BlackRock. We're going to talk in the course of this hour, Steve, about why you think it's misguided to see the industrial capitalist economy as real and finance as just froth. But I wanted to begin by asking you, what are the political stakes of getting this question wrong?
They're pretty significant. Basically, I mean, the idea that finance is a parasitic force on the real industrial economy effectively implies that workers should be forming an alliance with the good industrial capitalists, that is to say their bosses, to rein in the real parasites, the real exploiters, who are the financiers, and thereby to restore, supposedly, the good old days of post-war golden age Keynesian capitalism. And seeing finance and industry as deeply entangled, and in fact more deeply entangled than ever before, as we show in the book they are, implies that there is no such space for a social democratic compromise with a more progressive fraction of capital. And it's interesting because, you know, while a large chunk of the kind of social democratic left, especially people like William Lozonik, have been arguing that, you know, we can kind of form this alliance with industrial capital, with the rise of the new asset management companies, the big three, State Street, Vanguard, and BlackRock, since the 2008 crisis to become the most powerful institutions within the contemporary financial system. There's also been an argument that is fairly influential on the social democratic left that actually workers can form an alliance with these new financial institutions around fiscal expansion and perhaps the environment, given that they supposedly don't have as much of a strong interest in limiting inflation as traditional finance does. So basically, we kind of argue that seeing finance and industry as deeply interconnected as they are means that there is really no space for a social democratic compromise either with industrial capital nor with financial capital. And moreover, we argue that finance has been an essential, has created the essential infrastructure for industrial firms to circulate investment all over the world as part and parcel of what globalization has been about. And so therefore, the kind of third social democratic argument that we hear all the time, that basically capitalism is today monopolistic and effectively non-competitive, also is kind of barking up the wrong tree, in the sense that with the growing mobility of capital as financialization has proceeded and the financial system has become more elaborated and developed and globalized, capital has become more, not less, competitive. So competition is not a function of the number of particular sellers in a given sector of the economy. Competition takes place as a result of capital mobility, and it occurs as investment flows into those sectors with relatively high profits and out of those sectors with relatively low profits. So it follows from that the increasing mobility of capital, the greater ability of capital to circulate geographically and across branches of the economy, increases the competitive disciplines on all different investment outlets to either maximize monetary returns or face the withdrawal of investment. So the development of corporate capitalism, the financialization of the global economy, has made capitalism more, not less, competitive. So the idea that we should be, that the primary political task for workers is to be intensifying or restoring the competitiveness of capitalism by breaking up big firms is very much misguided. And in fact, large corporations in particular, which have today become deeply financialized in the sense that the people who run those corporations are effectively investors, effectively money capitalists, circulating investment across the different operations that the corporation controls, as well as expanding into new acquisitions and divesting from less profitable acquisitions, less profitable operations. Those large corporations are actually the most mobile and the most capable of flexibly restructuring their production and portfolio of operations as they're trying to maximize their profitability. So the idea that workers have an interest in restoring the competitiveness of capitalism, and that that should be the primary focus of our political efforts, is really very misguided. And in fact, competitiveness isn't good for workers in any case. Competitiveness means increasing competition among workers for jobs and increasing competition among states for investment in ways that have served to reduce wages, prevent and block struggles for expanded programs for social provision and political reforms at the level of the state and the like. So the focus on competitiveness is misguided both because it's not a good goal to adopt for the left, but also because the economy is more competitive than ever in the context of financialization and globalization.
And we'll return as we go further in the hour to the questions of what kind of relationship exists right now between finance and industry and the political implications of getting that right. But I wanted to ask you about financialization, this term, and the notion of finance capital. So, you know, the assumption, I think, the prevailing wisdom is that over the course of the century, in the latter third of the 20th century, rather, that the financial sector has become way more important in the U.S. economy and the economies around the world. And this indicates a kind of historic shift, and that financialization sort of changes the terrain on which the economy operates, on which the left has to struggle. And so it seems appropriate to ask you what we're talking about when we use this term financialization, or at least how you use it, and connecting it to the way finance has been theorized, at least in the Marxist tradition, going back to the early 20th century when the Austrian Marxist Rudolf Hilferding wrote about finance capital. Can you tell us how he theorized the concept and how you use that term, finance capital and financialization?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Sasha. And I think actually it gets at some of the really critical misconceptions about the way finance and financialization are often thought of in much of the contemporary discussion on the left about this, which is basically that financialization is something that has occurred at a relatively late stage of capitalism since the 1980s. The economy has become financialized, industry has declined, and this is a kind of sign that capitalism is falling apart and we're kind of nearing some kind of collapse or some potential deep crisis of capitalism. And in fact, as your reference to Hilferding suggests, finance and financialization is actually something that was present at the origins of corporate capitalism. Without finance, there would be no large corporation. There would certainly be no multinational corporation, but there would be no national corporation. As Hilferding showed in his classic text, Finance Capital, the accumulation of money capital and the centralization of credit generating capacities in investment banks was a critical condition enabling the formation of a corporation that could operate on a national and later international scale. So without those financial institutions, without the ability for industrial capital to draw on the combined savings of the entirety of society and to draw on the centralized credit generating capacities of the banking system, it'd be very hard to imagine the process of concentration and centralization that resulted in the formation of the corporation really occurring. And the way Hilferding conceived of this was what he called finance capital. And what that is, you know, generally, I think the term finance capital is misused. It is used widely on the left, but typically in the wrong way. Hilferding wasn't just referring to the financial sector. He was referring to a distinct fusion between financial and industrial capital, whereby because of the role of the banks in mobilizing investment and extending credit and organizing large corporations by merging together smaller, independent, usually kind of entrepreneurially owned, kind of family-owned, individually owned firms, they played the largest role in controlling and organizing corporations and in financing corporations. And so therefore, there was, through the development of the corporation in the late 19th century, there was a process whereby the distinctions between financial and industrial capital were increasingly blurred to eventually become effectively erased with the fusion of those two that Hilferding referred to as finance capital. So that's kind of what we argue has kind of returned in a certain form with the rise of the big three, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, since the 2008 crisis.
Well, tell us more about what that looked like, this sort of classical period of financial capital in the Gilded Age, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. What did finance capital look like then, and what was the relationship between banks and corporations, and what sort of tethered them together?
So it's interesting because, I mean, typically, and this is getting back to a comment I just made a second ago about this idea that capitalism has supposedly over time become less competitive as a monopoly stage replaced the supposedly competitive stage of earlier times. In fact, what happened in the 19th century with the formation of the large investment banks and their role in forming corporations, they played the leading and most active role in the development of corporate organization. What actually happened was barriers to the mobility of capital were broken down, and the internal market within the United States was integrated, allowing for the operation of national scale industrial corporations. Previously, the economy was highly regionalized, so it was actually pretty easy to form local regional monopolies. It was extremely expensive to move things around. Capital mobility was relatively low, and there was enormous barriers to entry in the sense of, you know, small local independent firms could easily form monopolies based on the limits of the ability to move capital around and limited integration of the market. So with the development of a national scale financial system, the internal market within the U.S. was unified and integrated in a new way, and allowed for the formation of corporations which could operate on a national scale. And those corporations depended for their expanded reproduction, as we say, their ability to profitably grow. They depended on the role of investment banks to extend them credit. And by virtue of those credit relations, the investment banks were also able to gain centralized control over ownership of stock in those corporations, and to put their allies, especially J.P. Morgan, right, the most important finance capitalist, the most important investment banker, was able to place his allies on the boards of directors of a range of different industrial corporations, such that he was able to effectively govern, play the largest role in governing all of the largest and most important industrial firms, all the way up until the 1929 stock market crash, when that system came to an end.
Stephen Marr is my guest. He's co-author with Scott Aquano of The Fall and Rise of American Finance from J.P. Morgan to BlackRock. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Steve, the argument that you make about the changing forms that finance capital has played over the course of U.S. history, although you note that often roots of new forms have taken hold earlier, that the periods that you mark out are really demarcated by the large crises of the capitalist economy. The period that you are talking about, or have been talking about, of a kind of classical financial capitalism came to an end with the stock market crash of 1929 and the crisis of capitalism at that time. And I wanted to ask you about how that juncture led to a new alignment of finance and industry with the New Deal, and what that reconfiguration looked like.
Yeah, so what you basically see is, you know, from the late 19th century through 1929, this process that we were just talking about of breaking down all barriers to the operation of the competitive movement of investment and capital within the U.S. market. Up until 1929, when that all came crashing down with the great crash of 1929, and the investment banks were effectively destroyed, at least their economic position was fundamentally reduced as a result of that great crash of 1929 and the following Great Depression. After that, you had the reconstruction by the state, especially, of the financial system, the attempt to rebuild a functioning, stable financial system, which gave rise to the kind of commercial banking model, whereby banks effectively specialized in making consumer loans. And the role of investment banks in the role of the financial institutions in governing industrial corporations was dramatically restructured, dramatically curtailed. They were effectively barred through New Deal regulations from playing this active role in governing industrial corporations. And the old investment banking model was effectively destroyed by virtue of the division of the banking sector into investment and commercial banking, with investment banks largely playing a kind of ancillary role in the issuing securities and so on, but not in centralizing control of those securities and in controlling industrial firms. So what ended up happening was, which was already kind of underway before 1929, there was a kind of broadening of stock ownership, a kind of diffusion of stock ownership kind of already underway prior to 1929. But after the crash, that really takes off in a much greater way. And you have a kind of fragmentation of share ownership across a wider range of different individual owners, which really prevents the emergence of a kind of concentrated block of ownership power at the level of equity that could counteract the influence or counterbalance the control of the industrial corporation by the internal management, the kind of paid professional managers that run these firms, which had developed over the finance capital period. But following the destruction of the investment bank's power over industrial firms, you really see corporate control centralized in the hands of those internal managers. And so what you see is a shift from kind of external corporate control by investment banks to internal corporate control by professional managers inside the firm. And they take on immediately at that time, which is interesting, a range of financial functions for which they had previously relied upon the investment bankers to carry out. And so one thing that happens at this point is you see the rise of the management consulting industry, whereby the capacities of these new corporate managers, now disconnected from the tutelage and overall hegemony of outside investment bankers, are developed by and supplemented by drawing on the advice, counsel, and capacity building activities of the management consulting firms that they work with, such as Boston Consulting and the like. So you see this shift in corporate control, a fundamental shift, the structure of corporate control, which becomes centralized in the hands of these insider managers who are not opposed in any coherent way by blocks of shareholder power outside the firm.
Well, you write that each of these periods where finance capital is reconfigured, part of the reconfiguration of finance capital, that is the intersection, interpenetration of finance and industrial capital, it is also in relationship to the state, that the state is a fundamental force in shaping this configuration. And I wanted to ask you about the state in the period that began with the New Deal and lasted through the post-war period up until the 70s. What role did the state play, and what was the importance of taxation in that period?
So, as you kind of said earlier, when you were talking about how we divide the development of American capitalism into four different phases, punctuated by these three great crises of capitalism, 1929, the 1970s crisis, and then the 2008 crisis. So the first, from 1880 roughly to 1929, we call the period of classical finance capital following Hilferding. And then from 1929 until 1979, through the 1970s crisis, we refer to that period, which is dominated by, in which the economy is really dominated by the power of these industrial firms, the managerial period. And in that period, the role of the state, what we call the New Deal state, really revolves around, first of all, supporting multinational corporations through massive state investment in the military-industrial complex. So you have a huge proportion of research and development costs, especially what's called basic research and development, which refers to kind of quote-unquote blue sky investment or investment in technologies and forms of knowledge that do not necessarily have immediate market applicability. And so therefore, you know, industrial corporations have no real incentive to undertake such expenses. The state really plays the largest role in research and development. The industrial firms then privatize the knowledge and technologies that is developed within the military-industrial complex and use it as the basis for product lines, which allow them to become the kind of leading and most competitive economic institutions in the global economy. So it's interesting because what's usually thought of as this kind of placid, peaceful, very nice golden age of capitalism, in fact, the wealth and power and competitiveness of American multinational corporations can't be separated from the role of the military-industrial complex, which is to say that the living standards and stability, quote unquote, of capitalism inside the United States can't be separated from the bombing of the Vietnamese and the destruction of Vietnam, for example. So the state, especially the military-industrial complex in that period, played a tremendous role. And the other major function of the state in that period was the development of what Scott and I refer to as the economic apparatus of the state following Poulantzas. Those state institutions that are directly involved in the reproduction and in circulation of capital. And one of the most important parts of that starts to emerge as what we call the financial branch. That part of the economic apparatus that is concerned especially with finance. So you see the expansion of the power of the Federal Reserve and also the development of a kind of regulatory incubator rooted in the New Deal regulations for nursing finance back to health, right? There's often this idea that, you know, this period, the managerial period, was characterized by kind of the financial suppression or financial restraint. And in fact, what it would be better described as characterized by, you know, a certain restraint on finance, but one that is also oriented towards rebuilding the stability and power of finance. There's a kind of contradiction between limiting the activities of finance, but also aiming to rebuild the health and power of the financial system. And so ultimately what happens is that incubator is discarded once you get, you know, into the 1970s and beyond, and allowing for the return of financial hegemony starting in the neoliberal period following 1979.
Well, we've been discussing the U.S. mainly domestically, but obviously we can't talk about the period from the 1930s to the 1980s without acknowledging the dominance of the United States as the global capitalist hegemon. And I wanted to ask you how you understand the importance of finance as it relates to the U.S. state as not just the organizer of the economy domestically, but in its growing management of global capitalism in this period and then beyond.
So yeah, I mean, in this period, kind of world trade is, you know, the global monetary and trade regime that's in place is what's called Bretton Woods. Which is basically organized around, you know, fixed exchange rates, which are centered around the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar is pegged to gold. So basically, the U.S. dollar is pegged at a certain rate of exchange to gold, and all the other currencies are pegged to the U.S. dollar. And so in this period, you have a kind of managed process of trade and kind of flows of international investment, which are organized around and aiming to enhance the legitimacy and the stability of international economic relationships so as to permit the consolidation of the American empire in that period. So states are allowed some autonomy from the disciplines of global financial flows in order to enact independent fiscal and monetary policies and thereby to stabilize and extend their internal markets and solidify the hegemony of capitalist classes in those contexts, which provides basically a framework for stable integration within which the American empire the power of the American empire can become established and consolidated. And this was always seen as a step contrary to social democratic arguments, which basically hold that we should go back to Bretton Woods, that we could somehow go back to the Keynesian golden age, and therefore, you know, we can have a better capitalism. And again, this is oftentimes conceived of as supposedly being able to come about through forming an alliance with industrial capitalists. You know, contrary to those arguments, this was always conceived of as a stage in the development of a more integrated global capitalism. So prior to the rise of the U.S. empire following World War II in the 1940s, you had a kind of global system of inter-imperial rivalry in which individual European countries each established their economic linkages to their exclusive economic colonies, which they ruled over to the exclusion of other capitalist classes and states. And what happens after World War II is that phase of history effectively comes to an end. And you see the rise of a new form of empire, an informal American empire, made up of formally independent states, whereby there is a single global capitalist system that comes into being. Not competing national or regional capitalisms or distinct colonial empires, but one global capitalism integrated together by the free movement of investment internationally and multinational corporations. And so that's really a massive shift, and it entails, you know, starting in the 1970s and 1980s with the rise of neoliberal globalization, it entails the tremendous empowerment of the Federal Reserve and the restructuring of what I was earlier referring to as the economic apparatus, which during the managerial period was very much dominated by the military-industrial complex.
Stephen Marr is my guest. He is co-author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So then in the 1960s, there was increasing in the late 60s, both the fallout from empire was starting to mount. At the same time, in the United States, workers were becoming more restive and profitability was becoming a real problem for U.S. companies. And then this was followed by the global economic crisis of the early 1970s and the rise in the late 70s, 1980s of what has been called neoliberalism. What did that look like and how did finance capital look in the neoliberal period?
The managerial period, the relatively low compared to now levels of income and wealth inequality during that period. Oftentimes, you know, the social democratic arguments that I'm critiquing here in terms of, you know, we should go back and form an alliance with industrial capital because, you know, they before finance came along and corrupted everything, you know, they were much nicer to workers and they invested in good jobs and you know, that sustained the emergence of a kind of middle class during the Keynesian period or the managerial period. So we should kind of see those as the good guy capitalists who made all that possible and go back to that period. In fact, what really happened was workers were able to win gains in wages and working conditions through the strength of collective bargaining at the workplace and through unionization. Right? It wasn't the benevolence of industrial capital that resulted in relatively low levels of income and wealth inequality. It was the strength of the trade union movement. And so this isn't corrupted by finance. It's brought to an end by the defeat of the working class starting in the neoliberal period. And what sustained it in part was the continual increases in productivity that accrued to the capitalist economy of the United States from the end of World War II all the way until the late 1960s. Basically, productivity, your output per worker per unit of time, was steadily increasing from the 1940s until the late 1960s. And so therefore, that allowed for the implementation of what is often referred to as productivism, whereby both wages and profits can rise together. So with increases in productivity, you have a fixed distribution of income between capital and labor, allowing for an increase in both profits and wages, right? Since they're each earning the same share of the total pie, but the pie is getting bigger as a whole. So therefore, both labor and capital can experience income growth because the total share of national income is expanding. Once you get to the late 1960s, productivity gains start to slow down. And by the time you're hitting the 1970s, you're really reaching a crisis. And what ends up happening is the productivist bargain, whereby workers, whereby trade unions can secure annual wage increases for workers alongside productivity gains, begins to break down. Because as productivity growth slows, continued militancy, wage militancy on the part of the trade unions starts to eat into profits. So rather than wage increases and profit increases happening together, it starts to be the case that wage increases are squeezing profits. And so the distribution of income actually starts shifting away from capital toward labor, squeezing capitalist profitability, and therefore resulting in a crisis whereby capital stops investing, leading to economic stagnation and crisis and creating the need to find a way to discipline the working class. So the trade union rights that were a cornerstone of the New Deal state during the managerial period, which was concerned, after all, with legitimation coming out of the massive class struggles from below of the 1930s. The New Deal reforms were oriented towards securing the legitimacy of the capitalist system to demobilize those massive working class struggles from below by extending certain reforms and union rights to workers. Well, that became a barrier to further accumulation starting in the 1970s with the crisis that I was just mentioning, the profitability crisis. But it's not possible to simply revoke trade union rights and say, okay, all those reforms we extended during the New Deal period, those are all gone now. And now you have to accept, you know, wage restraint and an end to collective bargaining and such forth. It required 10 years of struggle for capital to be able to force labor to ultimately accept the wage restraint necessary to restore profits and investment. And that took place both through two stages. First of all, they attempted to implement over the 1970s a range of wage and price control programs, which were effectively oriented towards restraining real wages and restoring profits. But that's pretty hard to do for elected officials, right? I mean, if you have to go back to your vote to voters to get reelected and your main policy program is vote for me, I'm going to reduce your living standards and real wages, it's not going to go very well. So it created a range of contradictions whereby Congress and elected officials were kind of had to play this game where they were pretending to also kind of fairly reduce, you know, restrain corporate profits and restrain price growth while also holding wages down. And so there was this kind of contradictory back and forth that made the programs effectively unworkable. And ultimately, there's, you know, a range of documentary evidence showing this. Executive branch officials were very concerned that workers or the public would ultimately seek to expand controls and expand the role of the state in setting prices for a range of different products and services that workers rely on. And so they were very worried about controls and they wanted to get rid of them as soon as possible, but they didn't know how to defeat the working class to make that possible, how to restrain real wage growth. So what they ended up doing was basically organizing a much more authoritarian state, whereby power was concentrated in institutions that were quote unquote independent, right? Regulatory independence being a neoliberal watchword, from political quote unquote intervention, as if the economy is not political. And so what happened was they effectively concentrated power in the Federal Reserve with the appointment of Paul Volcker to be the chair of the Federal Reserve at the end of the Carter administration, who massively increased interest rates, which ultimately provoked an economic recession, raising unemployment significantly, increasing competition among workers for jobs, therefore, and insecurity within the working class, and forcing workers to therefore accept wage restraint as a basic reality of the quote, supposedly unavoidable reality of the current period, of the neoliberal period that was then dawning. And so what's interesting to observe about the development of this, the emergence of this neoliberal authoritarian state, is that it's very much about circumventing and limiting the role of democratic accountability in setting, you know, the social policies that have the largest impact on people's lives, concentrating power in the Federal Reserve to massively increase interest rates, leading to a recession and spiking unemployment, disciplining the working class, and therefore paving the way for another round of globalization, which would effectively place workers in competition with a massive reserve army of labor all over the world, thereby effectively holding down wages. So it set in motion, it paved the way for another round of globalization, which effectively restrained workers' demands and constrained their horizons for what was possible by placing workers around the world in competition for jobs. Capital could now simply relocate, you know, production wherever it was cheapest in terms of the lowest wages and the lowest regulatory costs, which exerted massive discipline on the working class to restrain wage growth and restrain their political demands as well.
One of the ways that progressives tend to see the period of neoliberalism or globalization is about the retreat of the state, the idea that the state has retreated and instead let markets run amok. But what you're actually arguing is that the state has played a crucial role in facilitating the strength and power of capital, including finance capital, in the neoliberal period.
Yeah, so you see this process of resolving the 70s crisis through the development of a much more authoritarian neoliberal state, a much more coercive state. You see the contradiction in the capitalist state between its legitimation functions, legitimation meaning all of those measures that the capitalist state undertakes to legitimate the capitalist system, ranging from elections to social welfare programs and beyond. And these legitimation functions of the capitalist state become a barrier to accumulation. There's a contradiction between legitimation and accumulation. And in that context, in the absence of the ability of workers to successfully fight back and mobilize on behalf of an alternative, accumulation, the state turns from legitimation to accumulation. Legitimation is subordinated to the demands of accumulation. And the state restores profits through effectively circumscribing democracy, circumscribing the role of the Congress, circumscribing the role of political parties and elections, insulating the most important centers of state power, whereby the most important economic and social policies are made, from public input. At the same time, through the extension of capital, the globalization of capital and the integration of global financial markets, the centralization of power in the Federal Reserve is further reinforced, because the Federal Reserve has to play a larger role than ever before in managing an increasingly volatile global monetary and trade order, characterized no longer by fixed exchange rates and the dollar gold standard of the Bretton Woods period that I mentioned earlier, which also had to be replaced in the wake of the inflationary pressures of the 1970s crisis, with a free floating exchange rate system in which currencies internationally were exchanged not based on a fixed exchange rate to each other and ultimately to gold, but based on supply and demand. And that was an incredibly volatile, that is an incredibly volatile by comparison, international monetary order, which requires constant coordinated intervention by central banks in order to maintain currency stability and low inflation above all. So it requires the coordination among central banks internationally, which is orchestrated by the American state as part of its imperial function. And it requires continuous economic intervention by central banks to maintain stability. It also means that in the context of globalization, you know, the new round of globalization that emerges from the 1970s crisis, it means that corporations seeking to circulate investment across different currency zones, the volatility of the monetary order that emerges following Bretton Woods, the neoliberal monetary regime, means that corporations have to find a way of managing the incredible risks of currency devaluations and so on that can wipe out profits before the commodity that's being produced even makes it to market. So they do so by engaging in extensive derivatives trading, by derivatives which basically insure against the risk of currency fluctuations and exchange rate fluctuations, thereby allowing corporations to manage the risks that might jeopardize profits before the commodity is even brought to market.
Right. So what might seem like crazy speculative mania actually serves a function in terms of risk management. I should say I'm speaking with Stephen Marr. He is co-editor of the Socialist Register and author or co-author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're arguing when we look at the history of U.S. finance from the late 19th century to the present, that there have been these turning points that have been punctuated by economic crises of the capitalist system. And we saw one, of course, in 2008, a financial crisis that nearly took the banks and the global economy down. And I wanted to ask you what kind of new relationship of finance and industrial capital was consolidated out of the wreckage of the global financial crisis of 2008?
The role of the Federal Reserve in rebuilding the financial system following the meltdown of 2008, I mean, it's easy to overlook the fact that the 2008 crisis was in many respects as deep as the 1929 crash. It was the worst crisis of capitalism since the Great Depression, and therefore one of the worst crises of capitalism ever. And it required tremendous intervention on the part of the central bank to manage the effects of that crisis and rebuild a stable financial system. And basically what happened was the crisis was often is often blamed on, you know, irrational speculation or on derivatives, which, as I just mentioned, were actually integral to the neoliberal global monetary and trade order. But in fact, what happened was what emerged was a crisis of the system of market-based finance, as it called, that emerged from the over the neoliberal period. And what that system basically is a way of generating credit whereby banks don't necessarily play the only or leading role in the process of credit creation. Instead, you have a range of financial institutions that all play a role in generating credit through exchanging financial assets. The most important of these financial assets is mortgage-backed securities. So the process of credit creation within this relatively decentralized system of market-based finance hinges on the willingness of investors to accept mortgage-backed securities as collateral in exchange for loans, basically. And so in the event that there is a problem with the value of mortgage-backed securities, or that these assets are no longer viewed as good as gold, so to speak, and investors are no longer willing to accept them as collateral, credit creation can't happen. It freezes up. And that's effectively what occurred. And so the state, it wasn't just a matter of Henry Paulson slapping his buddies at Goldman Sachs on the back and giving them bailouts. It was the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department bailing out the assets that are absolutely at the foundation of the entire credit system. In the event that the value of mortgage-backed securities isn't seen as stable and sound, then the whole financial system, as it came to be organized over the neoliberal period, can't function. And so what the state was doing was effectively supporting the value of those assets, and therefore supporting the integrity and stability of the entire financial system. And what they basically ended up doing was nationalizing all of the major institutions and assets that are the major foundations of the financial system, and integrating them much more closely with state power, and flooding the financial system with liquidity through continual rounds of what was called quantitative easing, whereby the state extended huge amounts of liquidity into the financial system. And what this served to do, basically, the way that quantitative easing worked is to buy up the safest assets that banks and other financial institutions hold, especially treasury bonds. By buying treasury bonds, the state effectively reduced the supply in the financial system of what are seen generally as the safest assets to hold. So, and at the same time as they're flooding the financial system with money. And since financial institutions like to make money, they need to find another profitable way to invest all of the money that is being flooded into the financial system through quantitative easing. And the way that they did that was by investing in other assets that were generally seen as more risky than treasury bonds, but the next riskiest assets, especially corporate stock. So as the state is buying up all of the outstanding treasury bonds and flooding the financial system with liquidity, financial institutions are then turning to purchase, you know, assets that would that are more risky than treasury bonds, but like the next riskiest assets. This is what's called pushing them down the yield curve. And basically, they end up at corporate stock as a major outlet for this investment. And so you see this tremendous concentration of the ownership of corporate stock that effectively results in the emergence of the greatest level of concentration and centralization of ownership since 1929 in the hands of the giant asset management companies, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. So they come to own collectively something like 98% of total market capitalization in the US economy, with an average stake in 20% of each firm. And the reason why the large asset management companies come to be so powerful and so significant is because they are the managers of what are called passively managed funds. So we normally think of financial trading and active management as being basically, you know, highly paid money managers engaging in trading financial assets to beat the market and get the best returns for their clients. Passively managed funds are different. Passively managed funds are contractually limited so that they can only trade so as to reflect the changing weight of firms in a given index. So the NASDAQ, the FTSE 1000, the S&P, you know, an index of that basically ranks a range of firms according to different criteria. And basically, a passively managed fund tracks an index such that the weight of firms in the portfolio reflects the weight of firms in an index. So as a firm becomes, you know, rises in a ranking on a particular index, that fund would automatically, quote unquote, purchase shares in that firm. As a firm falls in its ranking on an index, that passively managed fund would sell shares of that firm. So it's just tracking the weight of firms in a particular index based on a set of performance criteria that are established by that index. And so in the context whereby you have this huge flood of money going into corporate stock, and therefore a huge appreciation of the price of corporate stock across the board, a rising tide lifts all boats. And it becomes very hard to justify the very high management fees paid to active managers to engage in active trading in order to, quote unquote, you know, capture alpha, that is to say, beat the market. And instead, these passively managed funds become very competitive as they offer extremely low management fees and relatively high returns in the context of this huge appreciation of corporate stock prices. So that leads to a huge flood of money into passive investment funds, including from pension funds as well as high income households, thereby fueling this tremendous concentration and centralization of corporate ownership in the hands of the big three asset management companies.
Well, let me end by asking you what the significance is of this change that has happened since 2008, because since the New Deal, ownership, i.e. shareholders, and control, i.e. managers, were held separate. But you're saying that they've been merged in these asset management companies that are incredibly powerful, and not just economically powerful. They have the ear of Joe Biden. BlackRock executive Brian Deese is Biden's top economic advisor. So what is the significance for the rest of us of finance capital taking the form that it has right now, which you're arguing is unprecedented? And are there any vulnerabilities that you can flag in this new configuration?
What's important to point out about this process whereby this tremendous, unprecedented wave of concentration and centralization. I mean, really unprecedented in the whole history of capitalism in terms of the scale and scope of the holdings that these firms have, is that this is still capitalism. So there's an argument out there that the asset management companies' concentration and centralization of ownership holdings has kind of resulted in the formation of a planned economy and has blunted competition by, you know, basically allowing these firms to construct command economies and blocking the firms that they own from competing with one another, which is supposedly in their interests. And as we show in the book, this is just completely wrong. These asset management firms have a overwhelming interest in the competitiveness of individual portfolio companies that they hold. So they are very much interested in maximizing. If you look at all their interventions around corporate governance at shareholder meetings and the like, their interventions are overwhelmingly oriented towards maximizing the competitiveness of the individual companies that they own and maximizing their profitability. So it's not economic planning. They're not constructing a planned economy. They have no interest in breaking with globalization or in empowering workers in a way that would lead to a reduction in profitability or competitiveness. They're very much interested in maximizing the competitiveness of their firms, and they're not, therefore, to be thought of as a kind of pro-worker, progressive financial bloc. They are just as much in favor of maximizing the exploitation of labor as traditional finance has been. So in terms of the weaknesses of the system, I think we're faced with a kind of polarization of options, whereby workers have to realize, I think the left and the working class has to come to recognize that we even winning significant reforms in the context in which there is no progressive arm or progressive fraction of capital that is willing and able to compromise on a range of different necessary social programs and the like, it's going to require an intense struggle on the part of the working class, even in order to get significant reforms on the agenda. And that is a very difficult position to be in, particularly given the fact that the working class is as weak as it's ever been since 1848. And so ultimately, I think the horizon of our politics has to be thinking about how to move from private control of finance toward a public control of investment, such that rather than being allocated on the basis of competitiveness and profit maximization, we can determine how the economy works in order to serve social and ecological needs, and to start thinking through how we can transition to a system of socialist economic planning.
Stephen Moore, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sasha.
Stephen Moore is Associate Professor of Economics at SUNY Cortland. He's co-author with Scott Aquano of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.